we're considering something that is very negative and that we don't like, HIV. But I want to ask you that as we hear many of the negative things, aspects that Brendan has been bringing out and that I will bring out also, we should think also of some of the positive aspects. And if you want to get them highlighted for you, I invite you to examine very closely the quilt that Sandra and her companions have prepared. Sandra, would you let the people see who you are? Where there are such beautiful expressions as, I am a mother, I am a wife, I am HIV, I am happy to be who I am. And that is the spirit that is within many of the people who have HIV, and that is the spirit that we admire in them, and that is the spirit that encourages so many of us to try and join hands with them, so as with them to overcome this ferocious disease that has struck us in the human race. I'd like to re-echo many of the remarks that Brendan has made, and especially to appreciate all that has been done by Ireland in this regard. I'd like to thank the Irish people very warmly for their support for HIV activities worldwide and here in Ireland, and to thank them for the continued support for this World AIDS Day event, this annual event, which even in difficult financial times is going ahead. At the same time, I would like to congratulate Ireland on an award that was made to Ireland only within the last 10 days or so, that it received an award for its commitment to addressing the challenges of international migration of highly skilled persons from the developed world. I gather that you were talking about some of this at the last meeting of the conference here that has just ended. And Ireland has shown itself, as in so many other areas, to be pulling its weight, much more than pulling its weight, to be boxing much above its weight. And in a person like Brendan, out of the Irish Embassy in Lusaka, and one of his successors, he's here in hiding, Bill Nolan, who had been the ambassador in Zambia, and other, Bernie Crawford, who is here, Nicola Brennan, who is here, and other Irish personnel who have worked in the Irish Embassy in Zambia. Listen, you people who haven't gone out there, you should be standing up proud of these people and acclaiming them. Forget about Kelly and think about these people. These are the people who have put Ireland on the map in a good way, and God bless them for it. And the people of Zambia are saying that when Ireland is around, we feel things are all right. And that is thanks to Brendan and to all of those that I have mentioned. As Brendan and Nadine have said, these lectures have been going on since 2006. And the first of the lectures was on stigma and discrimination. It got tremendous support, as was said already, from Bertie Ahern. And it was held at the time of the launch of the Stamp Out Stigma campaign. And that campaign has led to great positive things. Even one of the photograph from Wexford shows that there is some ability at overcoming the stigma. Not entirely yet, but it is there. This evening, we're considering another area, gender and HIV, with something on sexuality maybe. That's an area where there's a huge amount of discrimination, inequity, shameful treatment of people, mostly against women and girls, unacceptable treatment. And maybe we need now a stamp out discrimination campaign, S-O-D. Get rid of it now, once and for all, and get it out of our system. Get it out of not our just personal system, but out of our systems. In government, in civil life, in private life, in every dimension. And this problem of stigma, discrimination, inequity in the treatment of women, it comes up very strongly in the whole area of HIV and AIDS. There has been remarkable progress. Brendan has outlined some of it to you. But for millions of people, the disease has now been transformed so that it is no longer life-threatening as it was, but a disease that is manageable, but nonetheless a disease, and therefore something that should not be with us. The great achievement has been the development of the drugs, the antiretroviral drugs, which have saved the lives of so many millions of people, but also the fact, as again as Brendan said, that such a record number of people are on these drugs, 10.5 million at the beginning of this year. In my own country, in Zambia, we estimate that over 90% of the people, over 90% of those who are in need of antiretroviral therapy are now receiving it. They don't always stay on it for a variety of reasons, but about 90% or a bit more are receiving that therapy, and that is surely a wonderful achievement. But the epidemic is not yet over. It is still with us, and we must bear that in mind. It's not over for the 35 million people in the world who are HIV infected. And some of them, maybe in this room. And it's worthwhile noting that of those 35 million people, more than 10% now are over the age of 50. The epidemic is moving up into my age bracket. Moving up because people are living longer who have received the drugs. And because we have failed in the world to recognize that just because you're over 50, you don't stop being a sexual human being. That remains until 5 minutes after they put your lid on the coffin. So this is something that is happening. We saw in one of the Tropra slides that it is the leading cause of death among women of reproductive age between 15 and 44. It's the sixth leading cause of death worldwide at the moment. And because people are living longer, there are more new infections than AIDS deaths. More people are becoming infected than are dying. More are coming into the pool than are leaving it. And this, of course, creates enormous problems and has great implications for the future, the costs, the disease burden on countries, stigma and discrimination, and the inequality and the treatment of women And let us never, never, never forget the suffering of the individuals. They're not statistics, they are people. And they are suffering, and we can never forget them. There are a number of developments that we have to consider and that causes worry. I said that we have a great achievement at present of well over 10 million people on the drugs. The objective is to get universal access, that is regarded as 80% or above on the drugs, by the year 2015, which is only 2 years away. We're not going to achieve that. But apart from all the logistical problems, there's the problem of money. It's estimated that between 2014 and 2016, $87 billion will be required to respond to HIV, TB, and malaria. That money is not going to be forthcoming. Last year, 2012, less than $20 billion was made available. In the current economic climate, that money is not going to rise anymore. In fact, at present, we notice that it is flatlined, that the graph was going up year by year, but now it has gone flat and is wobbling a little bit down, a little bit up, but it is not going up in the way that is required. And in some of our countries, the dimensions of this epidemic are absolutely ginormous. They're like something out of science fiction. Just last night I read that in Swaziland, a small country surrounded by South Africa, currently the AIDS prevalence is 31% of the adult population. One in every three people are infected. And women between the ages of 30 and 34, the infection rate is over 53%. One asks how a country like that is going to survive even, because it is a small country with a small population. In my own country, Zambia, in Lusaka, which has about 2 million people at present, the estimate is that it's about 25% are infected. In other words, one in every four people that you meet on the street may well be infected. When I was lecturing university, and I would be dealing with some of these things with the students, I would ask every fourth student or sixth student to stand up, and I would say, right, that's approximately the number of people in this part of Zambia, at any rate, that are infected with this disease. Yes, there is control through the drugs, and ultimately that will, we believe, bring less transmission of the disease, but currently there is still far too much transmission of it. And who suffers? Well, obviously the individuals suffer. But as a group, no one suffers more than the women. The women and the girls. When this disease was developing in the 1990s and the year 2000, up to about the year 2007 or 8, there were more men than women infected. Now, worldwide, there are many more women infected than men. Now, that speaks of a gender discrimination of two kinds, against the women and, strangely, against the men. Against the women, because they are so vulnerable to this disease, and I'll look at the vulnerability in a few moments, and they are at such risk of it. And against the men, because even though there are large numbers able to receive antiretroviral therapy, the number of men who present themselves is not in any way equal to the number of women. Men are macho. I don't get sick. I don't need a doctor. I can look after myself. I don't need to be tested. And they're discriminating against themselves because they are men and have to continue to portray this male image of machismo of one kind or another. And in that way, they're signing their own death warrant, many of them, by not going for the treatment. Whereas the women are much more open to medical treatment and will present, and it is a social occasion for them sometimes going there, whereas a man would sit grumpily by himself, hating to have to go into a doctor, especially to talk about sensitive issues like this. And it's not only HIV. I was glad that Brendan mentioned that we have to have other issues coming in here. But we know now that in settings where HIV prevalence is high, as in sub-Saharan Africa, and particularly in the southern cone of Africa, from Kenya down to the south, TB prevalence is also very high. And the rates of TB in the 15 to 24-year-old population is 1.5 to 2 times higher than it is in countries that do not have HIV. There is a link between these, and one makes you more vulnerable to contracting the other. And so it's far wider than just HIV. It's over at TB, and it is over at other diseases also. Several years ago, I think it must be about 8 or 9 years ago now, two men who were very powerful in the world at the time, Stephen Lewis of the United Nations and James Morris of the World Food Programme, said this: the incredible assault of the HIV and AIDS epidemic on women has no parallel in human history. The pandemic is preying on them relentlessly, threatening them in a way that the world has never yet witnessed. And that is how it is. I said that more women than men are living with HIV. Among young women again in the age bracket 15 to 24, HIV is much higher than among young men. In South Africa, for instance, 11.5% of the young women have HIV, only 4.5% of the young men. There is a huge difference there. And why is it, what is it that is making women so vulnerable, making them so wide open to attack by this virus and by this disease? Well, I think of it along three different dimensions: physiological and health grounds. The physiology of the human body, of the woman's body, more fragile, more extensive tissues in the female genital areas, infected fluids staying there longer than they would in the body of a male, larger volumes of this fluid reaching these delicate organs, the result being that HIV transmission from male to female is 7 times more likely than the other way around, from female to male. I sometimes say what we're dealing with is a faulty design. And I intend, when I see the maker, to bring that to his attention. And I'll be seeing him before many of you, to promise you that. But there is that whole problem just in the very fact of being a woman. That cannot be avoided, and it is there, objectively speaking. But also we have to recognize that HIV has a woman's face in a different dimension. It is the women who are doing the most against the disease. It is the women who are leading an effective response. We have to think of the women in home-based care. We have to think of the many women who are involved in NGOs and CBOs of various kinds. We only have to look around the room here at the moment and see that it is predominantly women who are with us here this evening. In the religious domain, I belong there, the Catholic Church is providing maybe 25% or more of the AIDS care across the world. But nearly all of that is women. We priests, and we talk, they work and do it. But there's another factor with the women that we certainly have to take into account. The social vulnerability. They are very vulnerable because of the way we have adopted certain social and cultural norms. We have double standards in society. Maybe they're a little bit more smooth here than they are in less developed societies, but by and large, I think we have to acknowledge that we have a society where few women can negotiate the where, the when, the how of sex, that we have a society where women are expected to show a certain amount of sexual naivete, while men are expected to show a great deal of sexual knowledge and even experience. I remember some years ago speaking with university students in Jamaica, and the extraordinary thing there was that nearly all of them were women. Men don't go to university so much there. Education is something for the women. And I said to them, how is it that since you are the more educated part of Jamaican society, and you're also getting the better jobs, the bigger jobs, how is it, or why is it, that HIV is such a problem amongst you people in Jamaica? And one of them immediately put up her hand and she said, sir or father, I forget what she said, you forget, once the door is closed on the bedroom, he is the boss, not me. And I have to do whatever he tells me, and if there's HIV around, there's nothing I can do about it in the face of him. Now, that's a society norm. That is something that was bred into them from the time that they were younger. Let me just read these words from a Zambian woman, and many women in other parts of Africa, and I think many other parts of the world would re-echo these words. Before my marriage, I was counseled by elderly female relatives who emphasized that a woman should take a subordinate role within the household and should obey her husband. They even said that violence against women within the household was normal and acceptable, and that a woman should remain in her marriage regardless of her husband's behavior. Being taught from the time they were young that he's the boss, and you don't question it, even if there is this deadly disease which he can so easily pick up and transmit to her. And then in our societies, we have a number of harmful practices. Age mixing, young girls with older men, sugar daddies, many of them, not all of them, but they're paying the rent maybe, or they're paying for the children to go to school, the older men, and the girls are their partners, but he has other partners as well. She knows that, and she knows the risk. But she has to keep the kids at school. She has to pay the rent. She has to get the household necessities. So she has to have sex. She may even be married, and her husband may realize that she is engaging in such activities, but he says nothing because it keeps the food on the table or it keeps the landlord away from the door. We have these damaging customary practices. Girls being married too early, before their bodies are fit to be the bodies of mothers, the damage that that does to the health of the girl, but also that the girl is unable to protect herself in any way against the possible onslaught of this disease. We have a practice, it's fairly universal in Zambia, of what's called dry sex. Inserting certain herbs into the vagina, it's chose to dry it out, with the belief that this gives the men more pleasure and that the men are demanding it. I've been at groups with men and I've asked them about this and they said, oh no, no, we would never do that. We would never, they want to do it. And so they cast the blame back on the women. Now, it might not be the same practice here in the Western world, but I'm sure you are aware that there are practices like to this and that you hear about them and the way they put the women in an inferior status. If you were to sum the whole thing up, apart from the examples of it, I think what we have to say is that society in general agrees in giving women an inferior status. And then we have one other thing, which again Brendan mentioned, but which we have got to mention, the violence against women. The violence against women and girls. The United Nations Commission, High Commissioner for Human Rights, believes that violence against women is the most pervasive and universal form of all human rights violations. We hear about many of the others, maybe because they're less common. We don't hear enough talk about this, but it is so common in societies across the world, and it is something that is living on the back of the HIV epidemic, an HIV epidemic living on the back of the violence against women, that this is happening so universally and it is such a problem. And as we know from the stories we hear, what we see in the media, heard from the media, from so many parts of the world, systematic sexual violence, gender-based violence, seems to be part and parcel of many of the armed conflicts that are going on, used as a tool for terrorization, used as a tool for ethnic cleansing, not just in Africa, not just in the Congo at the moment, but we only have to throw our minds a few years back to Serbia and to all of that part of the world and what was going on there, to Chechnya and what's going on there, and to Syria today. And this is part and parcel of life, unfortunately, and it is something that is entirely against our ideals of human rights, but it is also something that greatly increases the risk of HIV for women. I mentioned already the stereotyped gender images. Machismo, the man, the idea that the man needs sexual activity. During when this epidemic was spreading in India at the beginning of this millennium, the routes were very often the big long truck routes, and the truck drivers were blamed for spreading it, and they still are blamed in many parts, including in Zambia, with the trucks coming up from South Africa. And when the Indian drivers were confronted, mostly by NGOs, to try and cool it and that, they replied, you don't know how it is when you're driving a truck, when you've driven 500 miles on one of these long, hard roads. You must have sex after it. You need it to cool the body. We sad for the men, but even sadder for the women who become infected in this way, and this perverted image that this is something that is required. And yet, behind it all, we have to ask again, is there something working on the men here that we have not taken into account? One of my friends, a man called Tony Simpson, whom some of you may have known, is in the University of Manchester, has written a book about men and aging, or men and sex in Zambia. And he has a wonderful line in it where he talks, says that the powerful gaze of the peer group is never far away. Trying to do what the peer group requires from the group in the pub, the group at a game, the group in a village, at a village beer party, doing what others are demanding and not doing what they feel themselves they should be doing and what is required. I'm going to risk spending a few moments telling you a fable. And it's a fable, but like all fables, there's a great truth in it. The fable is, when God created Adam and Eve, he had two parts left. He wasn't sure how to share them out between them, so he said he'd ask them. So he called them and he said, listen guys, I have two things left, one for each of you. Do you want to hear about them? And Adam immediately said, what are they? Well, God said, the first one is a thing you attach. And when you have it attached and it has become part of you, you'll be able to pass water outside it, standing up. And Adam immediately started jumping up and down. Oh, let me have that. I want that. That's made for me. God looked at Eve, and Eve said, yeah, let him have it. And they gave it to him, fitted it on. And Adam went around jumping with joy. He put his name on the sand. He hit every tree he could see. He went to the stones and knocked them over. He said, this is great. Now at last, I am a man. I am a real man. And Adam and God and Eve looked on, smiling. And then God turned to Eve and he said, well, I'm sorry. There's only one thing left. You'll have to do with it, make do with it. And Eve said, that's okay. What's it called? And God said, brains. Isn't there something in it? Isn't there something in it that this identification of a man with sexuality with prowess, with leading in these areas, and the woman following, using her head all right, as much as she's allowed to use her head, but not always allowed to use it. The high expectations that she would remain faithful to her partner, responding to a man, is her primary role. Yes, she can have sexual pleasure, but that's not the primary thing. Her primary thing, so many women are taught, instructed, is to ensure that the man has sexual pleasure, and hers comes secondary to him. In other words, we have built into this whole sexual area a subordination of women to men, and that is not right. That is not the way it should be. And that perspective is something that helps very much to bring the whole AIDS issue, all HIV, so very, very far forward. So I think that one of the things that has got to be done in this area is that there must be a total transformation in gender norms. We've gone along too many years with them. They are dishonorable. They are disempowering for women. They are debasing and destructive for men as well as for women. And if our generation doesn't set about changing these things and making them more human, then we're going to have problems. At the end of last week or earlier this week, the World Health Organization produced a booklet, 16 ideas for dealing with violence against women, but it summed them up, many of them up at any rate, by saying we must do something about changing and transforming our gender norms and our cultural norms. And I believe that this change is required not just for dealing with HIV, but so that we respect women. We're not trying to bring a change around here in order to keep a disease under control. That's important, absolutely, very important. But much, much more important is the dignity and the respect that is due to a woman as a fellow human being. And that we work for that, and that we try to achieve that, and in achieving that, that we do achieve something that will help us also to overcome one big aspect of the HIV epidemic. A long time ago, the then director of what was known as the World AIDS Programme, I think it was called, a man called Jonathan Mann, he was killed tragically in an air crash, I think it was in the Pyrenees, he said, the low status of women is at the heart of the AIDS epidemic. And the central issue isn't technological or biological, it is the inferior status and role of women. When women's human rights and dignity are not respected, society creates and favours their vulnerability to AIDS. But friends, we're living at a time when there are changes coming about in the relationship between men and women. And I think what we should be trying to do is to speed up these changes, to bring them forward more quickly, not just because of AIDS, but because of human dignity, because of people who they are. And you might say, that's very difficult. How are we to do that? I don't know how we're to do it, but I know that we must do it. And maybe the first part of the how is that we're committed to doing it, no matter how hard it may be. George Bernard Shaw once said you'd get it on a card in some of the card shops. Some look at things and they, that are and ask why. I look at things that never were and I ask why not? Equality between women and men. I look at that and I ask why not? It never was. Hard to achieve, but if we don't set our hearts on achieving it, we will never achieve anything in that area or anything fitting our human dignity. This year, 2013, is 50 years since the great Martin Luther King gave his wonderful dream address. I have a dream, you may know it, many of you. He had a dream of real freedom for the people of color in the United States. And he hoped that one day the United States would stand up and live out its creed that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men and women are created equal. But I've been very bold, and I've taken Martin Luther King's words, at least some of them, some of his dream speech, and I've adjusted it to fit the dream of equality between men and women. If you like, when I say the words, I have a dream, you can say them out yourself, say it out loud, so that you're expressing a commitment to something that is worthwhile. And Dr. King began, I say to you today, my friends, that in spite of the difficulties and frustrations of the moment, I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the most noble of our human dreams. I have a dream that one day our world will turn into reality its belief that women and men are fully equal to one another in every aspect. I have a dream. I have a dream that one day the whole world will see the countries of Asia and Africa and all other countries as shining lights of freedom, justice, reconciliation, and respect between men and women on an equal footing. I have a dream that those who follow us will live in a society where they will not be classified by the label of their gender, but by the quality of their character. I have a dream that one day we shall see that there is no more exploitation of women, no more gender-based violence, no more discrimination between male and female, but that we are all one in our common humanity. And in King's words again, friends, let equality ring. Let equality ring from every town and every village, from every province and every city. And then we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, women and men, girls and boys, will be able to join hands and triumphantly sing, equal at last, equal at last. Thanks be to God, we are equal at last. That is our dream. That is our hope. Let us all work together to make it a reality. Thank you.
silence is what it feels appropriate for me after that. Thank you so much, by the way. In honoring you as you've honored others tonight, I wanted to share something with you. Father Michael received another award. He was honored in his hometown of Tullamore last week. And he received a letter, a message from the Taoiseach that I thought we would like to share with you tonight. Dear Father Michael, I want to send you my heartiest congratulations as you were honored in your native town and county. For over 50 years, you have dedicated yourself to the service of the people of Zambia. In particular, you are recognized as a renowned expert in perhaps the greatest challenge on the continent, the scourge of AIDS. We have all witnessed the devastation that this disease has wrought on communities through Africa. You recognize the catastrophic effects this would bring in the future, particularly in the education sector, and you brought education, and indeed education on the disease, to the fore. You have ensured a greater understanding. You called it a social vaccine, and your approach has been advocated by the leading bodies and professionals throughout the world. I had the privilege to meet you last year when you received the Presidential Distinguished Award at Oras Anuthron. I was greatly struck by your humility and your deep conviction to the service of others. You are committed to social justice, human rights, and the basic dignity of the person. Moreover, you are committed to the very real work of saving lives and communities throughout Africa. Ireland has a long and wonderful history of commitment to the developing world. Father Michael, you are a shining example of this tradition, and you richly deserve the recognition you have received. To be honored in the town of your birth is a truly special occasion, and one which I hope you thoroughly enjoy. With my very best wishes, Enda Kenny, Taoiseach. So I would just like to ask, Father Michael mentioned Sandra, he asked you to stand up earlier, and we wondered if you wouldn't mind to come up and just share with us a little bit about the history of the beautiful quilt that we saw at the back of the room. And some of our friends are going to move the quilt before us so that we can hear again the beautiful voices of women living with HIV in Ireland.
Hi everybody. As Nadine said, my name is Sandra. I walk in Open Heart House, but I'm also HIV positive myself. A group of women came together, we meet up every Wednesday, and we wanted to say something. There's lots of quilts out there that are in memory of people who have passed away, and we wanted to have something that shows us that are still alive, like kicking and trying to live our lives. The women that came together to do this don't want to be seen as victims. They want to be part of the community. They want to contribute in some way. They want to send out a message of hope to all other women, men, children living with HIV, to say that you're not alone, and that together we can make a difference. So this is just a small contribution that the women came up with.
Brilliant.